Yes, Clary said, and took a step toward him. He tore his gaze away from her.
The jacket you borrowed from me in the park yesterday, he said. Do you still have it?
Now looking even more puzzled, Clary pointed to where the item of clothing in question, a perfectly ordinary brown suede jacket, was hanging over the back of one of the chairs.
It's over there. I was going to bring it to you after.
Well, said Jace, picking it up and thrusting his arms hastily into the sleeves as if he were suddenly in a hurry.
Now you don't have to.
Jace, Luke said in that calming tone he had, we're going to get an early dinner in Park Slope after this. You're welcome to come along.
Nah, Jace said, zipping up a jacket. I've got training this afternoon. I better head out.
Training? Clary echoed.
But we trained yesterday. Some of us have to train every day, Clary.
Jace didn't sound angry, but there was a harshness to his tone, and Clary flushed.
I'll see you later, he added without looking at her, and practically flung himself toward the door.
As it shut behind him, Clary reached up and angrily yanked the pins out of her hair. It cascaded and tangled down around her shoulders.
Clary, Luke said gently.
He stood up.
What are you doing?
My hair. She yanked the last pin out hard. Her eyes were shining, and Simon could tell she was forcibly winning herself not to cry.
I don't want to wear it like this. It looks stupid.
No, it doesn't. Luke took the pins from her and set them down on one of the small white end tables.
Look, weddings make men nervous, okay? It doesn't mean anything.
Right. Clary tried to smile. She nearly managed it, but Simon could tell she didn't believe Luke. He could hardly blame her. After seeing the look on Jace's face, Simon didn't believe him either. In the distance, the Fifth Avenue diner was lit up like a star against the blue twilight. Simon walked beside Clary down the avenue blocks, Jocelyn and Luke a few steps ahead of them. Clary had changed out of her dress and was back in jeans now, a thick white scarf wound around her neck. Every once in a while, she would reach up and twirl the ring on the chain around her neck, a nervous gesture he wondered if she was even aware of. When they'd left the bridal store, he had asked her if she knew what was wrong with Jace, but she hadn't really answered him. She'd shrugged it off and started asking him about what was going on with him, if he talked to his mother yet, and whether he minded staying with Eric. When he told her he was crashing with Kyle, she was surprised.
But you hardly even know him, she said. He could be a serial killer. I did have that thought. I checked the apartment out, but if he's got an ice cooler full of arms in it, I haven't seen it yet. Anyway, he seems pretty sincere.
So what's his apartment like?
Nice, for Alphabet City. You should come over later.
Not tonight, Clary said, a little absently. She was fiddling with the ring again.
Maybe tomorrow? I want to see Jace, Simon thought,
but he didn't press the point. If she didn't want to talk about it, he wasn't going to make her.
Here we are.
He opened the diner door for her, and a blast of warm souvlaki-smelling air hit them. They found a booth over by one of the big flat-screen TVs that lined the walls. They crowded into it as Jocelyn and Luke chatted animatedly with each other about wedding plans. Luke's pack, it seemed, felt insulted that they hadn't been invited to the ceremony, even though the guest list was tiny, and were insisting on holding their own celebrations in a renovated factory in Queens. Clary listened, not saying anything. The waitress came around, handing out menus so stiffly laminated they could have been used as weapons. Simon set his own on the table and stared out the window. There was a gym across the street, and he could see people through the plate glass that fronted it running on treadmills, arms pumping, headphones clamped to their ears.
All that running and getting nowhere, he thought. Story of my life.
He tried to force his thoughts away from dark places and almost succeeded. This was one of the most familiar scenes in his life, he thought. A corner booth in a diner, himself and Clary and her family. Luke had always been family, even when he hadn't been about to marry Clary's mom. Simon ought to feel at home. He tried to force a smile, only to realize that Clary's mother had just asked him something and he hadn't heard her. Everyone at the table was staring at him expectantly.
Sorry, he said. I didn't... What did you say?
Justin smiled patiently.
Clary told me you've added a new member to your band.
Simon knew she was just being polite. Well, polite in that way parents were when they pretended to take your hobbies seriously. Still, she'd come to several of his gigs before, just to help fill up the room. She did care about him. She always had.
In the very dark, tucked-away places of his mind, Simon suspected she had always known how he felt about Clary, and he wondered if she wouldn't have wanted her daughter to make a different choice, had it been something she could control. He knew she didn't entirely like Jace. It was clear even in the way she said his name.
"Yeah," he said. "Kyle, he's kind of a weird guy, but super nice."
Invited by Luke to expand on the topic of Kyle's weirdness, Simon told them about Kyle's apartment. Careful to leave out the detail that it was now his apartment too, his bike messenger job and his ancient beat-up pickup truck.
"And he grows these weird plants on the balcony," he added. "Not pot, I checked. They have sort of silvery leaves."
Luke frowned, but before he could say anything, the waitress arrived carrying a big silver coffee pitcher. She was young, with bleached pale hair tied into two braids. As she bent to fill Simon's coffee cup, one of them brushed his arm. He could smell sweat on her, and under that blood, human blood, the sweetest smell of all. He felt a familiar tightening in his stomach, coldness spread through him, he was hungry. And all he had back at Kyle's place was room-temperature blood that was already beginning to separate, a sickening prospect even for a vampire.
"You have never fed on a human, have you? You will. And when you do, you will not forget it."
He closed his eyes. And when he opened them again, the waitress had gone, and Clary was staring at him curiously across the table. "Is everything okay?"
"Fine."
He closed his hand around his coffee cup. It was shaking. Above them, the TV was blaring the nightly news.
"Ah," Clary said, looking up at the screen.
"Are you listening to this?"
Simon followed her gaze. The news anchor was wearing that expression news anchors tended to wear when they were reporting on something especially grim.
"No one has come forward to identify an infant boy found abandoned in an alley behind Beth Israel Hospital several days ago," he was saying. "The infant is white, weighs 6 pounds and 8 ounces, and is otherwise healthy. He was discovered strapped to an infant car seat behind a dumpster in the alley," the anchor went on. "Most disturbing, a handwritten note tucked into the child's blanket begged hospital authorities to euthanize the child because, 'I don't have the strength to do it myself. Police say it is likely the child's mother was mentally ill and claim they have promising leads. Anyone with information about this child should call Crime Stoppers at—'"
"That's so horrible," Clary said, turning away from the TV with a shudder. "I can't understand how people just dump their babies off like they're trash."
"Jocelyn,"
Luke said, his voice sharp with concern. Simon looked towards Clary's mother. She was as white as a sheet, and she looked as if she were about to throw up. She pushed the plate away abruptly, stood up from the table, and hurried toward the bathroom. After a moment, Luke dropped his napkin and went after her.
"Oh, crap." Clary put her hand over her mouth. "I can't believe I said that. I'm so stupid."
Simon was thoroughly perplexed.
"What's going on?"
Clary slunk down in her seat.
"She was thinking about Sebastian," she said.
I mean, Jonathan, my brother, I assume you remember him."
She was being sarcastic. None of them was likely to forget Sebastian, whose real name was Jonathan, and who had murdered Hodge and Max, and had nearly succeeded in helping Valentine win a war that would have seen the destruction of all Shadow Hunters. Jonathan, who had had burning black eyes and a smile like a razor blade. Jonathan, whose blood had tasted like battery acid when Simon had bitten him once. Not that he regretted it.
"But your mom didn't abandon him," Simon said. "She stuck with raising him even though she knew there was something horribly wrong with him."
"She hated him, though," Clary said. "I don't think she's ever gotten over that. Imagine hating your own baby. She used to take out a box that had his baby things in it and cry over it every year on his birthday. I think she was crying over the son she would have had, you know? If Valentine hadn't done what he had."
"You would have had a brother," Simon said. "Like an actual one. Not a murdering psychopath."
Looking close to tears, Clary pushed the plate away.
"I feel sick now," she said. "You know that feeling like you're hungry but you can't bring yourself to eat?"
Simon looked over at the bleached-haired waitress who was leaning against the diner counter.
"Yeah," he said. "I know."
Luke returned to the table eventually, but only to tell Clary and Simon that he was taking Jocelyn home. He left some money,
which they used to pay the bill before wandering out of the diner and over to Galaxy Comics on 7th Avenue. Neither of them could concentrate enough to enjoy themselves, though, so they split up, with a promise to see each other the next day. Simon rode into the city with his hood pulled up and his iPod on, blasting music into his ears. Music had always been his way of blocking everything out. By the time he got out at 2nd Avenue and headed down Houston, a light rain had started to fall, and his stomach was in knots. He cut over to 1st Street, which was mostly deserted, a strip of darkness between the bright lights of 1st Avenue and Avenue A. Because he had his iPod on, he didn't hear them coming up behind him until they were nearly on him. The first intimation he had that something was wrong was a long shadow that fell across the sidewalk overlapping his own. Another shadow joined it, this one on the other side. He turned and saw two men behind him. Both were dressed exactly like the mugger who had attacked him the other night. Grey tracksuits, grey hoods pulled up to hide their faces. They were close enough to touch him. Simon leaped back with a force that surprised him. Because his vampire strength was so new, it still had the power to shock him. When a moment later he found himself perched on the stoop of a brownstone several feet away from the muggers, he was so astonished to be there that he froze. The muggers advanced on him. They were speaking the same guttural language as the first mugger, who Simon was beginning to suspect had not been a mugger at all. Muggers, as far as he knew, didn't work in gangs, and it was unlikely that the first mugger had criminal friends who had decided to take revenge on him for their comrade's demise. Something else was clearly going on here. They had reached the stoop, effectively trapping him on the steps. Simon tore his iPod headphones from his ears and hastily held his hands up.
"Look," he said, "I don't know what this is about, but you really want to leave me alone."
The muggers just looked at him, or at least he thought they were looking at him. Under the shadows of their hoods, it was impossible to see their faces.
"I'm getting the feeling someone sent you after me," he said. "But it's a suicide mission. Seriously, I don't know what they're paying you, but it's not enough."
One of the tracksuited figures laughed. The other had reached into his pocket and drawn something out, something that shone black under the streetlights. A gun.
"Oh, man," Simon said. "You really, really don't want to do that. I'm not kidding."
He took a step back, up one of the stairs. Maybe if he got enough height, he could actually jump over them or past them. Anything but let them attack him. He didn't think he could face what that meant. Not again. The man with the gun raised it. There was a click as he pulled the hammer back. Simon bit his lip. In his panic, his fangs had come out. Pain shot through him as they sank into his skin.
"Don't!"
A dark object fell from the sky. At first, Simon thought something had merely tumbled from one of the upper windows, an air conditioner ripping loose, or someone too lazy to drag their trash downstairs. But the falling thing he saw was a person, falling with direction, purpose, and grace. The person landed on the mugger, knocking him flat. The gun skittered out of his hand, and he screamed a thin, high sound. The second mugger bent and seized the gun. Before Simon could react, the guy had raised it and pulled the trigger. A spark of flame appeared at the gun's muzzle, and the gun blew apart. It blew apart, and the mugger blew apart along with it, too fast to even scream. He had intended a quick death for Simon, and an even quicker death was what he got in return. He shattered apart like glass, like the outward flying colors on a kaleidoscope. There was a soft explosion, the sound of displaced air, and then nothing but a soft drizzle of salt falling onto the pavement like solidified rain. Simon's vision blurred, and he sank down onto the steps. He was aware of a loud humming in his ears, and then someone grabbed him roughly by the wrists and shook him hard.
"Simon! Simon!"
He looked up. The person grabbing him and shaking him was Jace. The other boy wasn't in gear, but was still wearing his jeans and the jacket he'd taken back from Clary. He was disheveled, his clothes and face streaked with dirt and soot. His hair was wet from the rain.
"What the hell was that?"
Jace asked. Simon looked up and down the street. It was still deserted. The asphalt shone black and wet and empty. The second mugger was gone.
"You?"
he said, a little groggily.
"You jumped the muggers?"
"They weren't muggers. They were following you since you got off the subway. Someone sent those guys."
Jace spoke with complete surety.
"The other one," Simon said. What happened to him?"
"He just vanished." Jace snapped his fingers. "He saw what happened to his friend and he was gone. Like that." I don't know what they were, exactly. Not demons, but not exactly human either.
Yeah, I figured that part out, thanks.
Jace looked at him more closely. That, what happened to the mugger? That was you, wasn't it? Your mark here.
He pointed at his forehead.
A sideburn white before that guy just dissolved.
Simon said nothing.
I've seen a lot, Jace said.
There was no sarcasm in his voice, for a change, or any mockery.
But I've never seen anything like that.
I didn't do it,
Simon said softly.
I didn't do anything.
You don't have to, said Jace.
His golden eyes burned in his soot-streaked face.
For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord.
Chapter 6. Wake the Dead. Jace's room was as neat as ever, bed made perfectly, the books that lined the shelves arranged in alphabetical order, notes and textbooks stacked carefully on the desk. Even his weapons were lined up along the wall in order of size, from a massive broadsword to a set of small daggers. Clary, standing in the doorway, held back a sigh. The neatness was all very well. She was used to it. It was, she had always thought, Jace's way of exerting control over the elements of a life that otherwise might seem overwhelmed with chaos. He had lived so long not knowing who, or even what, he really was. She could hardly begrudge him the careful alphabetization of his poetry collection. She could, however, and did, begrudge the fact that he wasn't there. If he hadn't gone back home after leaving the bridal shop, where had he gone? As she looked around the room, a feeling of unreality came over her. It wasn't possible that any of this was happening, was it? She knew how breakups went from hearing other girls complain about them. First the pulling away, the gradual refusal to return notes or phone calls, the vague messages saying nothing was wrong, that the other person just wanted a little space. Then the speech about how, it's not you, it's me. Then the crying part. She'd never thought any of that would ever apply to her and Jace. What they had wasn't ordinary, or subject to the ordinary rules of relationships and breakups. They belonged to each other totally, and always would. And that was that. But maybe everyone felt that way. Until the moment they realized they were just like everyone else, and everything they thought was real shattered apart. Something that glittered silver across the room caught her eye. It was the box Amatis had given Jace, with its delicate design of birds around the sides. She knew he had been working his way through it, reading the letters slowly, going through the notes and photos. He hadn't said much about it to her, and she hadn't wanted to pry. His feelings about his biological father were something he was going to have to come to terms with on his own. She found herself drawn to the box now, though. She remembered him sitting on the front steps of the Accords Hall in Idris, holding the box in his lap. "As if I could stop loving you," he'd said. She touched the lid of the box, and her fingers found the clasp, which sprung open easily. Inside were scattered papers, old photographs. She drew one out and stared at it fascinated. There were two people in the photograph, a young woman and a young man. She recognized the woman immediately as Luke's sister, Amatis. She was gazing up at the young man with all the radiance of first love. He was handsome, tall and blonde, though his eyes were blue, not gold, and his features less angular than Jace's. And yet still, knowing who he was, Jace's father, was enough to make her stomach tighten. She set the photo of Stephen Herondale down hastily, and nearly cut her finger on the blade of a slim hunting dagger that lay crosswise in the box. Birds were carved along the handle. The blade of it was stained with rust, or what looked like rust. It must not have been cleaned properly. She shut the box quickly and turned away, guilt like a weight on her shoulders. She had thought about leaving a note, but deciding it would be better to wait until she could talk to Jace in person, she left and went down the hall to the elevator. She had knocked on Isabel's door earlier, but it didn't look like she was home either. Even the witch-like torches in the hallways seemed to be burning at a lower level than usual. Feeling utterly depressed, Clary reached for the elevator call button, only to realize it was already lit. Someone was heading up from the ground floor to the Institute. Jace, she thought immediately, her pulse jumping. But of course, it might not be him, she told herself. It could be Izzy, or Maris, or... Luke? She said in surprise as the elevator door opened. What are you doing here? I might ask you the same thing. He stepped out of the elevator, pulling the gate shut behind him. He was wearing a fleece-lined zip-up flannel jacket that Jocelyn had been trying to get him to throw away since they'd first started dating. It was rather nice, Clary thought, that just about nothing seemed to change Luke, no matter what happened in his life. He liked what he liked, and that was that, even if it was a ratty-looking old coat. Except I think I can guess. So, is he here? Jace? No. Clary shrugged, trying to look unconcerned. It's fine. I'll see him tomorrow. Luke hesitated. Clary. Lucien. The cool voice that came from behind them was Maris's. Thank you for coming on such short notice. He turned and nodded at her. Maris? Maris Lightwood stood in the doorway, her hand lightly on the frame. She was wearing gloves, pale gray gloves that matched her tailored gray suit. Clary wondered if Maris ever wore jeans. She had never seen Isabel and Alec's mother in anything but power suits or gear. Clary, she said, I didn't realize you were here. Clary felt herself flush. Maris didn't seem to mind her coming and going, but then Maris had never really acknowledged Clary's relationship with Jace at all. It was hard to blame her. Maris was still coping with Max's death, which had been only 6 weeks ago. And she was doing it alone, with Robert Lightwood still in Idris. She had bigger things on her mind than Jace's love life. I was just leaving, Clary said. I'll give you a ride back home when I'm done here, Luke said, putting a hand on her shoulder. Maris, is it a problem if Clary remains while we talk? Because I'd prefer to have her stay. Maris shook her head. No problem, I suppose, she sighed, raking her hands through her hair. Believe me, I wish I didn't need to bother you at all. I know you're getting married in a week. Congratulations, by the way. I don't know if I told you that before. You didn't, said Luke, but it's appreciated. Thank you. Only 6 weeks. Maris smiled faintly. Quite a whirlwind courtship. Luke's hand tightened on Clary's shoulder, the only sign of his annoyance. I don't suppose you called me over here to congratulate me on my engagement, did you? Maris shook her head. She looked very tired, Clary thought, and there were strands of gray in her upswept dark hair that hadn't been there before. No, I assume you've heard about the bodies we've been finding for the past week or so? The dead shadow hunters. Yes. We found another one tonight, stuffed in a dumpster near Columbus Park, your pack's territory. Luke's eyebrows went up. Yes, but the others... The first body was found in Greenpoint, Warlock territory. The second floating in a pond in Central Park, the domain of the Fae. Now we have werewolf territory. She fixed her gaze on Luke. What does that make you think? That someone who isn't very pleased about the new accords is trying to set Downworlder against Downworlder, Luke said. I can assure you my pack didn't have anything to do with this. I don't know who's behind it, but it's a very clumsy attempt, if you ask me. I hope the Clave can see through it. There's more, Maris said. We've identified the first two bodies. It took some time, since the first was burned nearly beyond recognition, and the second was badly decomposed. Can you guess who they might have been? Maris. Anson Pagborn, she said, and Charles Freeman, neither of whom, I might note, have been heard from since Valentine's death. But that's not possible, Clary interrupted. Luke killed Pangborn back in August at Renwick's. He killed Emil Pangborn, said Maris. Anson was Emil's younger brother, They were both in the circle together. As was Freeman, said Luke. So someone is killing not just Shadowhunters, but former Circle members? And leaving their bodies in Downworlder territory? He shook his head. It sounds like someone's trying to shake up some of the more recalcitrant members of the Clave. Get them to rethink the new Accords, perhaps. We should have expected this. I suppose, Maris said. I've met with the Seelie Queen already, and I've a message out to Magnus, wherever he is. She rolled her eyes. Maris and Robert seemed to have accepted Alec's relationship with Magnus with surprisingly good grace, but Clary could tell that Maris, at least, didn't take it seriously. I just thought, perhaps, she sighed. I've been so exhausted lately, I feel like I can hardly think straight. I hoped you might have some idea about who might be doing this, some idea that hadn't occurred to me. Luke shook his head. Someone with a grudge against the new system. But that could be anyone. I suppose there's no evidence on the bodies? Maris sighed. Nothing conclusive. If only the dead could talk, eh, Lucien? It was as if Maris had lifted a hand and yanked a curtain across Clary's vision. Everything went dark, except for a single symbol hanging like a glowing sign against a blank night sky. It seemed her power had not vanished, after all. What if, she said slowly, raising her eyes to look at Maris, what if they could?
Staring at himself in the bathroom mirror in Carl's small apartment, Simon couldn't help but wonder where that whole business about vampires not being able to see themselves in mirrors had come from. He was able to see himself perfectly well in the dinged surface. Tussled brown hair, wide brown eyes, white, unmarked skin. He had sponged off the blood from his cut lip, though his skin had already healed over. He knew, objectively speaking, that becoming a vampire had made him more attractive. Isabel had explained to him that his movements had become graceful and that, whereas before he had seemed disheveled, somehow now he looked attractively rumpled, as if he had just gotten out of bed. Someone else's bed, she had noted, which, he told her, he had already figured out, was what she meant, thank you. When he looked at himself, though, he didn't see any of that. The poreless whiteness of his skin, as it always did, disturbed him, as did the dark, spidering veins that showed at his temples, evidence of the fact that he had not fed today. He looked alien, and not like himself. Perhaps the whole business about not being able to see yourself in a mirror once you had become a vampire was wishful thinking. Maybe it was just that you no longer recognized the reflection looking back at you. Cleaned up, he headed back into the living room, where Jace was sprawled out on the futon couch, reading Kyle's beaten-up copy of The Lord of the Rings. He dropped it onto the coffee table as Simon came in. His hair looked newly wet, as if it splashed water on his face from the kitchen sink.
I can see why you like it here,
he said, making a sweeping gesture that encompassed Kyle's collection of movie posters and science fiction books.
There's a thin layer of nerd all over everything. Thanks. I appreciate that.
Simon gave Jace a hard look. Up close under the bright light of the unshaded overhead bulb, Jace looked ill. The shadows Simon had noticed under his eyes before were more pronounced than ever, and his skin seemed tight over the bones of his face. His hand shook a little as he pushed his hair from his forehead in a characteristic gesture. Simon shook his head as if to clear it. Since when did he know Jace well enough to be able to identify which gestures of his were characteristic? It wasn't as if they were friends.
You look lousy, he said.
Jace blinked.
Seems an odd time to start an insult contest, but if you insist, I could probably think up something good. No, I mean it. You don't look good.
This from a guy who has all the sex appeal of a penguin? Look, I realize you may be jealous that the good Lord didn't deal you the same chisel hand he dealt me, but there's no reason to.
I am not trying to insult you, Simon snapped. I mean, you look sick. When was the last time you ate anything?
Jace looked thoughtful. Yesterday.
You ate something yesterday, you sure?
Jace shrugged. Well, I wouldn't swear on a stack of Bibles. I think it was yesterday, though. Simon had investigated the contents of Carl's fridge earlier when he'd been searching the place, and there hadn't been much to find. A withered-up old lime, some soda cans, a pound of ground beef,
and inexplicably, a single Pop-Tart in the freezer. He grabbed his keys off the kitchen counter.
Come on, he said. There's a supermarket on the corner. Let's get you some food.
Jace looked as if he were in the mood to object, then shrugged.
Fine, he said, in the tone of someone who didn't much care where they went or what they did. Let's go.
Out on the front steps, Simon locked the door behind him with the keys he was still getting used to, while Jace examined the list of names next to the apartment doorbell buzzers.
That one yours, huh?
He asked, pointing to 3A.
How come it just says Kyle? Doesn't he have a last name? Kyle wants to be a rock star, Simon said, heading down the stairs. I think he's working on the one name thing, like Rihanna.
Jace followed him, hunching his shoulders slightly against the wind, though he made no move to zip up the suede jacket he'd retrieved from Clary earlier that day.
I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm sure you don't.
As they rounded the corner onto Avenue B, Simon looked at Jace sideways.
So, he said, were you following me? Or is it just an amazing coincidence that you happened to be on the roof of a building I was walking by when I got attacked?
Jace stopped at the corner, waiting for the light to turn. Apparently even shadow hunters had to obey traffic laws.
I was following you. Is this the part where you tell me you're secretly in love with me? Vampire mojo strikes again?
There's no such thing as vampire mojo, said Jace, rather eerily echoing Clary's earlier comment.
And I was following Clary, but then she got into a cab. And I can't follow a cab. So I doubled back and followed you instead. Mostly for something to do. You were following Clary, Simon echoed. Here's a hot tip. Most girls don't like to be stalked.
She left her phone in the pocket of my jacket, Jace said, patting his right side where presumably the phone was stashed.
I thought if I could figure out where she was going, I could leave it where she'd find it. Or, Simon said, you could call her at home and tell her you had her phone, and she could come and get it from you.
Jace said nothing. The light changed, and they headed across the street towards the Seatown supermarket. It was still open. Markets in Manhattan never closed, Simon thought, which was a nice change from Brooklyn. Manhattan was a good place to be a vampire. You could do all your shopping at midnight, and no one would think it was weird.
You're avoiding Clary? Simon observed. I don't suppose you want to tell me why.
No, I don't. Jace said. Just count yourself lucky I was following you, or...
Or what? Another mugger would be dead?
Simon could hear the bitterness in his own voice.
You saw what happened?
Yeah. And I saw the look on your face when it did. Jace's tone was neutral. That wasn't the first time you'd ever seen that happen, was it?
Simon found himself telling Jace about the tracksuit of figure who had attacked him in Williamsburg and how he had assumed it was just a mugger. After he died, he turned into salt,
he finished.
Just like the second guy. I guess it's a biblical thing, pillars of salt, like Lot's wife.
They had reached the supermarket. Jay shoved the door open and Simon followed him in, grabbing a miniature wheeled silver cart from the line near the front door. He started to push it down one of the aisles, and Jay followed him, clearly lost in thought.
So I guess the question is, Jay said, do you have any idea who might want to kill you?
Simon shrugged. The sight of all the food around him was making his stomach twist, reminding him how hungry he was, though not for anything they sold here.
Maybe Raphael. He seems to hate me, and he wanted me dead before.
It's not Raphael, said Jace.
How can you be so sure?
Because Raphael knows about your mark, and wouldn't be stupid enough to strike at you directly like that.
He knows exactly what would happen. Whoever's after you, it's someone who knows enough about you to know where you're likely to be, but they don't know about the mark. But that could be anyone.
Exactly, said Jace, and grinned. For a moment, he almost looked like himself again. Simon shook his head.
Look, do you know what you want to eat, or do you just want me to keep pushing this cart up and down the aisles because it amuses you?
That, said Jace, and I'm not really familiar with what they sell in mundane grocery stores. Maris usually cooks, or we order in food. He shrugged and picked up a piece of fruit at random. What's this?
That's a mango.
Simon stared at Jace. Sometimes it really was like Shadowhunters were from an alien planet.
I don't think I've ever seen one of those that wasn't already cut up, Jace mused.
I like mangoes. Simon grabbed the mango and tossed it into the cart.
Great. What else do you like?
Jace pondered for a moment.
Tomato soup, he said finally.
Tomato soup. You want tomato soup and a mango for dinner.
Jace shrugged. I don't really care about food.
Fine. Whatever. Stay here. I'll be right back.
Shadow Hunters. Simon seethed quietly to himself as he rounded the corner of an aisle lined with soup cans. They were a sort of bizarre amalgam of millionaires, people who never had to consider the petty parts of life, like how to shop for food or use MetroCard machines in the subway, and soldiers with their rigid self-discipline and constant training. Maybe it was easier for them, going through life with blinders on, he thought as he grabbed a soup can off the shelf. Maybe it helped you keep your focus on the big picture, which, when your job was basically keeping the world safe from evil, was a pretty big picture indeed. He was feeling nearly sympathetic towards Jace as he neared the aisle where he'd left him, then paused. Jace was leaning against the cart, turning something over in his hands. From the distance, Simon couldn't see what it was, and he couldn't get closer, because two teenage girls were blocking his way, standing in the middle of the aisle, giggling and crowding up against each other to whisper the way girls did. They were obviously dressed to pass for 21, in high heels and short skirts, push-up bras and no jackets to keep the chill away. They smelled like lip gloss. Lip gloss and baby powder and blood. He could hear them, of course, despite the whispering. They were talking about Jace, how hot he was, each daring the other to go up and talk to him. There was a great deal of discussion of his hair and also his abs, although how they could really see his abs through his t-shirt, Simon wasn't sure.
Black, he thought. This is ridiculous.
He was about to say, "Excuse me," when one of them, the taller and darker haired of the two, broke away and sauntered over to Jace, wobbling a little on her platform heels. Jace looked up as she approached him, his eyes wary, and Simon had the sudden panicked thought that maybe Jace would mistake her for a vampire or some kind of succubus and whip out one of his seraph blades on the spot, and they'd both be arrested. He needn't have worried. Jace just arched an eyebrow. The girl said something to him breathlessly. He shrugged. She pressed something into his hand and then dashed back to her friend. They wobbled out of the store, giggling together. Simon went over to Jace and dropped the soup can into the cart.
"So what was that all about?"
"I think," Jace said, "that she asked if she could touch my mango."
"She said that?"
Jace shrugged. "Yeah, then she gave me her number."
He showed Simon the piece of paper with an expression of bland indifference, then tossed it into the cart.
"Can we go now?"
"You're not going to call her, are you?"
Jace looked at him as if he were insane.
"Forget I said that," Simon said. "This sort of thing happens to you all the time, doesn't it? Girls just coming up to you."
"Only when I'm not glamored."
"Yeah, because when you are, girls can't see you because you're invisible."
Simon shook his head.
"You're a public menace. You shouldn't be allowed out on your own."
"Jealousy is such an ugly emotion, Lewis."
Jace grinned, a crooked grin that normally would have made Simon want to hit him. Not this time, though. He had just realized what it was that Jace had been playing with, turning over and over in his fingers as if it was something precious, or dangerous, or both. It was Clary's phone.
"I'm still not sure that this is a good idea," said Luke. Clary, her arms crossed over her chest to ward off the chill of the silent city, looked sideways at him. "Maybe you should have said that before we got here." "I'm fairly sure I did. Several times." Luke's voice echoed off the stone pillars that rose overhead, striped with bands of semi-precious stone, black onyx, green jade, rose carnelian, and blue lapis. Silvery witchlight burned in torches attached to the pillars, lighting the mausoleums that line each wall to a bright white that was almost painful to look at. Little had changed in the silent city since the last time Clary had been here. It still felt alien and strange, though now the sweeping runes that stretched across the floors in carved whorls and etched patterns teased her mind with the edges of their meanings, instead of being totally incomprehensible. Maris had left her and Luke here in this entry chamber the moment they had arrived, preferring to go and confer with the Silent Brothers herself. There was no guarantee they'd let the three of them in to see the bodies, she'd warned Clary. Nephilim dead were the province of the Bone City's guardians, and no one else had jurisdiction over them. Not that there were many such guardians left. Valentine had killed nearly all of them while searching for the mortal sword, leaving alive only the few who had not been in the Silent City at the time. New members had been added to their order since then, but Clary doubted there were more than 10 or 15 Silent Brothers left in the world. The harsh clack of Maris's heels on the stone floor alerted them to her return before she actually appeared, a robed Silent Brother trailing in her wake. "Here you are," she said, as if Clary and Luke weren't exactly where she'd left them. "This is Brother Zachariah. Brother Zachariah, this is the girl I was telling you about." The Silent Brother pushed his hood back very slightly from his face. Clary held back a start of surprise. He didn't look like Brother Jeremiah had, with his hollowed eyes and stitched mouth. Brother Zachariah's eyes were closed, his high cheekbones each marked with the scar of a single black rune. But his mouth wasn't stitched shut, and she didn't think his head was shaved either. It was hard to tell, with the hood up, whether she was seeing shadows or dark hair. She felt his voice touch her mind. "You truly believe you can do this thing, Valentine's daughter?" She felt her cheeks flush. She hated being reminded of whose daughter she was. "Surely you've heard of the other things she's done," said Luke. "Her rune of binding helped us end the mortal war." Brother Zachariah raised his hood to hide his face. "Come with me to the ossuarium." Clary looked at Luke, hoping for a supportive nod, but he was staring straight ahead and fiddling with his glasses the way he did when he was anxious. With a sigh, she set off after Maris and Brother Zachariah. He moved as silently as fog, while Maris's heels sounded like gunshots on the marble floors. Clary wondered if Isabel's propensity for unsuitable footwear was genetic. They followed a winding path through the pillars, passing the great square of the Speaking Stars, where the Silent Brothers had first told Clary about Magnus Bane. Beyond the square was an arched doorway set with a pair of enormous iron doors. Into their surfaces had been burned runes that Clary recognized as runes of death and peace. Over the doors was written an inscription in Latin that made her wish she had her notes with her. She was woefully behind in Latin for a shadow hunter. Most of them spoke it like a second language.
"Taciat colloquia, effugiat risus. Hic locus est ubi mors, gaudet succurrere vitae."
"Let conversation stop. Let laughter cease," Luke read aloud. "Here is the place where the dead delight to teach the living." Brother Zachariah laid a hand on the door. "The most recent of murdered dead has been made ready for you. Are you prepared?" Clary swallowed hard, wondering exactly what it was she had gotten herself into. "I'm ready." The doors swung wide, and they filed through. Inside was a large, windowless room with walls of smooth white marble. They were featureless, save for hooks on which hung silvery instruments of dissection, shining scalpels, things that looked like hammers, bone saws, and rib spreaders. And beside them on shelves were even more peculiar instruments, massive corkscrew-like tools, sheets of sandpapery material, and jars of multicolored liquid, including a greenish one labeled acid, that actually seemed to be steaming. The center of the room featured a row of high marble tables. Most were bare. Three were occupied. And on two of those three, all Clary could see was a human shape, concealed by a white sheet. On the third table lay a body, the sheet pulled down to just below the ribcage. Naked from the waist up, the body was clearly male, and just as clearly a shadow hunter. The corpse's pale skin was inked all over with marks. The dead man's eyes had been bound with white silk, as per shadow hunter custom. Clary swallowed back her rising nausea and moved to stand beside the corpse. Luke came with her, his hand protectively on her shoulder. Maris stood opposite them, watching everything with her curious blue eyes, the same color as Alex. Clary drew her steely from her pocket. She could feel the chill of the marble through her shirt as she leaned over the dead man. This close, she could see details. That his hair had been reddish-brown, and that his throat had been torn clean through in strips, as if by a massive claw. Brother Zachariah reached out and removed the silk binding from the dead man's eyes. Beneath it, they were closed. "You may begin." Clary took a deep breath and set the tip of the steely to the skin of the dead shadow hunter's arm. The rune she had visualized before, in the entryway of the institute, came back to her as clearly as the letters of her own name. She began to draw. The black mark lines spiraled out from the tip of her steely, much as they always did, but her hand felt heavy, the steely itself dragging slightly, as if she were writing in mud rather than on skin. It was as if the implement were confused, skittering over the surface of the dead skin, seeking the living spirit of the shadow hunter that was no longer there. Clary's stomach churned as she drew, and by the time she was done and had retracted her steely, she was sweating and nauseated. For a long moment, nothing happened. Then, with a terrible suddenness, the dead shadow hunter's eyes flicked open. They were blue, the whites flecked red with blood. Maris let out a long gasp. It was clear she hadn't really believed the rune would work. By the angel. A rattling breath came from the dead man, the sound of someone trying to breathe through a cut throat. The ragged skin of his neck fluttered like a fish's gills. His chest rose, and words came from his mouth. "It hurts." Luke swore and glanced toward Zachariah, but the silent brother was impassive. Maris moved closer to the table, her eyes suddenly sharp, almost predatory. "Shadow Hunter," she said. "Who are you? I demand your name." The man's head thrashed from side to side. His hands rose and fell convulsively. "The pain! Make the pain stop!" Clary Steely nearly dropped from her hand. This was much more awful than she had imagined. She looked toward Luke, who was backing away from the table, his eyes wide with horror. "Shadow Hunter," Maris's tone was imperious. "Who did this to you? Please." Luke whirled around, his back to Clary. He seemed to be rummaging among the silent brother's tools. Clary stood frozen as Maris's gray-gloved hand shot out and closed on the corpse's shoulder, her fingers digging in. "In the name of the angel, I command you to answer me." The shadow hunter made a choking sound. "Downworlder. Vampire." "Which vampire?" Maris demanded. "Camille. The ancient one." The words choked off as a gout of black clotted blood poured from the dead mouth. Maris gasped and jerked her hand back. As she did so, Luke reappeared, carrying the jar of green acid liquid that Clary had noticed earlier. With a single gesture, he yanked the lid off and sloshed the acid over the mark on the corpse's arm, eradicating it. The corpse gave a single scream as the flesh sizzled, and then it collapsed back against the table, eyes blank and staring. Whatever had animated it, for that brief period, clearly gone. Luke set the empty jar of acid down on the table. "Maris," his voice was reproachful, "this is not how we treat our dead." "I will decide how we treat our dead, Downworlder." Maris was pale, her cheeks spotted with red. "We have a name now, Camille. Perhaps we can prevent more deaths." "There are worse things than death." Luke reached a hand out for Clary, not looking at her. "Come on, Clary. I think it's time for us to go."
"So you really can't think of anyone else who might want to kill you?" Chase asked, not for the first time. They'd gone over the list several times, and Simon was getting tired of being asked the same questions over and over. Not to mention that he suspected Jace was only partly paying attention. Having already eaten the soup Simon had bought, cold, out of the can, with a spoon, which Simon couldn't help thinking was disgusting, he was leaning against the window, The curtain pulled aside slightly so that he could see the traffic going by on Avenue B, and the brightly lit windows of the apartments across the street. Through them, Simon could see people eating dinner, watching television, and sitting around a table talking. Ordinary things that ordinary people did. It made him feel oddly hollow.
"Unlike in your case," said Simon. "There aren't actually all that many people who dislike me."
Chase ignored this.
"There is something you're not telling me."
Simon sighed. He hadn't wanted to say anything about Camille's offer, but in the face of someone trying to kill him, however ineffectually, maybe secrecy wasn't such a priority. He explained what had happened at his meeting with the vampire woman, while Jace watched him with an intent expression. When he was done, Jace said,
"Interesting. But she's not likely to be the one trying to kill you either. She knows about your mark, for one thing. And I'm not sure she'd be keen to get caught breaking the accords like that. When downworlders are that old, they usually know how to stay out of trouble."
He set his soup can down.
"We could go out again," he suggested. "See if they try and attack a third time. If we could just capture one of them, maybe we..."
"No," said Simon. "Why are you always trying to get yourself killed?"
"It's my job."
"It's a hazard of your job. At least for most shadow hunters. For you, it seems to be the purpose."
Jay shrugged.
"My father always said..." He broke off, his face hardening. "Sorry. I meant Valentine. By the angel. Every time I call him that, it feels like I'm betraying my real father."
Simon felt sympathetic towards Jace despite himself.
"Look, you thought he was your father for what, 16 years? That doesn't just go away in a day. And you never met the guy who was really your father. And he's dead. So you can't really betray him. Just think of yourself as someone who has two fathers for a while."
"You can't have two fathers."
"Sure you can," Simon said. "Who says you can't? We can buy you one of those books they have for little kids. Timmy Has Two Dads, except I don't think they have one called Timmy Has Two Dads and One of Them Is Evil. That part you're just going to have to work through on your own."
Chase rolled his eyes.
"It's fascinating," he said. "You know all these words and they're all English, but when you string them together in sentences, they just don't make sense."
He tugged lightly on the window curtain.
"I wouldn't expect you to understand."
"My father's dead," said Simon.
Chase turned to look at him. "What?"
"I figured you didn't know," said Simon. "I mean, it's not like you were going to ask or are particularly interested in anything about me. So yeah, my father's dead. So we do have that in common."
Suddenly exhausted, he leaned back against the futon. He felt sick and dizzy and tired, a deep tiredness that seemed to have sunk into his bones. Jace, on the other hand, seemed possessed of a restless energy that Simon found a little disturbing. It hadn't been easy watching him eat that tomato soup either. It had looked too much like blood for his comfort. Jace eyed him.
"How long has it been since you, ate? You look pretty bad."
Simon sighed. He supposed he couldn't say anything after pestering Jace to eat something.
"Hang on,"
he said.
"I'll be right back."
Peeling himself off the futon, he went into his bedroom and retrieved his last bottle of blood from under the bed. He tried not to look at it. Separated blood was a sickening sight. He shook the bottle hard as he headed into the living room, where Jace was still staring out the window. Leaning against the kitchen counter, Simon unscrewed the bottle of blood and took a swig. Normally, he didn't like drinking the stuff in front of other people, but this was Jace, and he didn't care what Jace thought. Besides, it wasn't as if Jace hadn't seen him drink blood before. At least Kyle wasn't home. That would be a hard one to explain to his new roommate. Nobody liked a guy who kept blood in the fridge. Two Jaces eyed him. One, the real Jace. The other, his reflection in the window pane.
"You can't just skip feeding, you know."
Simon shrugged.
"I'm eating now."
"Yeah," Jace said. "But you're a vampire. Blood isn't like food for you. Blood is... blood."
"That's very illuminating."
Simon flung himself into the armchair across from the TV. It had probably once been a pale gold velvet, but was now worn to the grayish pile.
"Do you have a lot of other profound thoughts like that? Blood is blood. A toaster is a toaster. A gelatinous cube is a gelatinous cube."
Jay shrugged.
Fine. Ignore my advice. You'll be sorry later.
Before Simon could answer, he heard the sound of the front door opening. He looked daggers at Jace.
That's my roommate, Kyle. Be nice.
Jace smiled charmingly.
I'm always nice.
Simon had no chance to respond to this the way he would have liked. For a moment later, Kyle bounded into the room looking bright-eyed and energetic.
Man, I was all over town today, he said.
I almost got lost, but you know what they say. Bronx is up, battery down.
He looked at Jace, registering, belatedly, that there was someone else in the room.
Oh. Hey, I didn't know you had a friend over.
He held out a hand.
I'm Kyle.
Jace did not respond in kind. To Simon's surprise, Jace had gone rigid all over, his pale yellow eyes narrowing, his whole body displaying that shadow hunter watchfulness that seemed to transform him from an ordinary teenage boy into something very much other than that.
Interesting, he said. You know, Simon never mentioned that his new roommate was a werewolf.
Clary and Luke drove most of the way back to Brooklyn in silence. Clary stared out the window as they went, watching Chinatown slide past, and then the Williamsburg Bridge lit up like a chain of diamonds against the night sky. In the distance, out over the black water of the river, she could see Renwick's, illuminated as it always was. It looked like a ruin again, empty black windows gaping like the eye holes in a skull. The voice of the dead shadow hunter whispered in her mind. The pain. Make the pain stop. She shuddered and drew her jacket more tightly around her shoulders. Luke glanced at her briefly but said nothing. It wasn't until he had pulled up in front of his house and killed the engine of the truck that he turned to her and spoke. Clary, he said. What you just did? It was wrong, she said. I know it was wrong. I was there, too. She swiped at her face with the edge of her sleeve. Go ahead and yell at me. Luke stared through the windshield. I'm not going to yell at you. You didn't know what was going to happen. Hell, I thought it might work, too. I wouldn't have gone with you if I hadn't. Clary knew this ought to have made her feel better, but it didn't. If you hadn't thrown acid on the rune, but I did. I didn't even know you could do that. Destroy a rune like that? If you disfigure it enough, you can minimize or destroy its power. Sometimes in battle, the enemy will try to burn or slice off a shadow hunter's skin just to deprive them of the power of their runes. Luke sounded distracted. Clary felt her lips tremble and pressed them together hard to stop the shaking. Sometimes she forgot the more nightmarish aspects of being a shadow hunter. This life of scars and killing, as Hodge had said to her once. Well, she said, I won't do it again. Won't do what again? Make that particular rune? I have no doubt you won't, but I'm not sure that addresses the problem. Luke drummed his fingers on the steering wheel. You have an ability, Clary. A great ability. But you have absolutely no idea what it means. You're totally untrained. You know almost nothing about the history of runes or what they have meant to Nephilim through the centuries. You can't tell a rune designed to do good from one designed to do harm. You were happy enough to let me use my power when it was the binding rune, she said angrily. You didn't tell me not to create runes then. I'm not telling you not to use your power now. In fact, I think the problem is that you so rarely do use it. It's not as if you're using your power to change your nail polish color or make the subway come when you want it. You use it only in these occasional life-and-death moments. The runes only come to me in those moments. Maybe that's because you haven't yet been trained in how your power works. Think of Magnus. His power is a part of him. You seem to think of yours as separate from you. Something that happens to you. It's not. It's a tool you need to learn to use. Jay said Maris wants to hire a rune expert to work with me, but it hasn't happened yet. Yes, said Luke. I imagine Maris has other things on her mind. He took the key out of the ignition and sat for a moment in silence. Losing a child the way she lost Max, he said. I can't imagine it. I should be more forgiving of her behavior. If something happened to you, I... His voice trailed off.